Session number 8735.
Dr. Saxton, tape 7.
My second visit to Grand Yen was, in fact, as director of a small hospital established in wooden structures, large sheds, you might say, purpose-built in a sense, for hospitals, but by no means elaborate. One enormous long room for ward and a few small rooms for other work, and for staff accommodation, such as it was, which was really the last thing that seemed to be thought of anyway. So just some odd room where you would doss down as usual, usually on a mattress if you're lucky, palliasse or whatever was available. In this hospital, we didn't have many wounded, not at least people who had been immediately wounded, except those from arid casualties. It was more a hospital for the sick. And while we were there, we did indeed have a typhoid epidemic. Now, this was on the banks of a river, and the river was obviously highly polluted. We don't think, we don't suggest even that it's been polluted above our hospital on purpose, but the effect is the same. And I must admit that I'd only seen one case of typhoid in my life before. I went to Spain, and I didn't find that one a very convincing case. Typhoid is, in fact, a disease which, at least as far as my diagnostic capacity is concerned, can be easily overlooked in the early stages, because, it's just like influenza. I mean, what is it? Oh, certainly you may have some intestinal complaints, but nothing very much to start with. It's simply a fever and feeling knocked out, just like flu, in fact. And since flu is such a common thing and typhoid is relatively rare, at least it was in my experience, I thought, well, a lot of people with flu about, you know, to start with. But the Spanish doctors were quicker off the mark because they'd seen a lot more typhoid, and it was soon realised what was going on. So this set us great problems of hygiene and control of food and boiling the water and also other problems, especially as toilet facilities and things like that were conspicuous by their absence. It was very difficult indeed. I mean, really, there was a lot of wild country around, and that was the toilet, so to speak. And we just had these sheds, and I can't recollect there was sheds built just to accommodate patients with very little in the way of drainage or anything of that sort, and everything had to be brought from the outside and taken to the outside. So that the control of these things was extremely difficult. We had people dying of typhoid, actually, in our hospital, including staff. I remember one Spanish nurse dying of typhoid, poor thing. She knew she was dying of typhoid. It's pathetic. Yes, well, and then we had inspectors coming around from the medical department of the government coming to see about this typhoid epidemic and coming inspecting the place. I don't think they felt we could do more than we were doing. Treatment of typhoid, especially in those days, was just supportive treatment. There was nothing you could do. Nowadays, antibiotics can be used in the treatment of typhoid, but we didn't have any antibiotics whatever in those days. Chemotherapy hadn't really developed, except in a few specific diseases, like if you could call it chemotherapy. There were specific treatments for a few diseases, like quinine for malaria, you know, salvarsan for syphilis. There were just a few diseases that could be treated with specific drugs, but there was no thing with a wide range, like the sulfonamides, used for the first chemotherapeutic agents, starting in Germany, really, but still, and penicillin, which was started in England, came much later. The sulfonamides were developed actually while we were still in Spain, but they didn't get to Spain. They didn't get there. So we had nothing of that sort. And anyway, sulfonamides are no good for
what
typhoid.
Other diseases were there, apart from typhoid, that you had to contend with?
Well, frankly, I can't remember many of them.
How about dysentery? Was there
much dysentery? Yes, a lot of dysentery. You're quite right. This is one of them. There were sort of things that came out of the blue you wouldn't expect. Some allergic to conditions or skin troubles. Run-of-the-mill things. But as you say, dysentery is very common. Well, anything like bronchitis, pneumonia, and these sorts of things cropped up here and there. And then there were a few wounded from air raids. We all seemed to be busy. I can't think. We had a dentist on our staff too, so we had dental surgery going on.
Were there many air raids in that area at this time?
Well, at this stage, there's quite a lot of Italian aviation around, and they used to fly over quite a lot, quite large formations, as it seemed to us. They didn't always attack us happily, but they did on occasion. So we had air raid precautions we were talking about. Well, our air raid precautions were a bit primitive. I mean, there were trenches in the fields without which one did go on occasion. But then the question was, sometimes the patients couldn't be moved, and some nurses would deliberately stay with their patients during air raids to sort of encourage them or do what they could. I remember one nurse who had to be a bit older than the others, but she was always, in a way, good for a laugh, in a sense, putting... had a lot of receivers, bowls, you know, enamel bowls of about, I don't know what, sort of 10-inch diameter types or something, 6 inches in diameter, various sizes for surgical purposes. And she nipped around the ward, putting one on each patient's head. I was doing something, and what can you do? You know, just something to make them think that they're not being just left. So that... in air raids, most of the staff would be encouraged, in fact, to go and take refuge, but those who felt brave enough to stay in would be also encouraged to stay with the patients and give them a little bit of moral support. It was... air raids are terrifying things. I mean, there must be very few people who are not frightened when things start going off with loud bangs, and you can hear things whistling through the air, and you wonder where they're going to land, and that sort of thing. I don't know. I suppose there are people who aren't frightened, but usually suspect that their lives if they sit.
Was the hospital ever hit? Any of your hospitals ever hit by a bomb?
We had two hospitals, really, more or less very close to each other, and the other one, when I wasn't in, had one end damaged, yes, quite severely damaged on one occasion. These places were all marked with the Red Cross, of course, but we were never quite sure. You know, every person blames his enemy for aiming at Red Crosses, and we naturally blamed our enemies for, in fact, picking on a Red Cross.
Would the patients have been lost alongside the damaged building? Were they killed or injured?
I don't think in that case they were. The only casualty that was closely associated with that raid that knocked that hospital down was perhaps one of these ones who is determined not to show fear. He was, in fact, an army officer who was had been a patient and was convalescent. He was close by this hospital. I don't know where. He was sitting outside in a chair, I think, or maybe there was some other building nearby he was at. At any rate, he was determined to stay, not to be frightened by these devils, and he sat in his chair and let it go, and he was hit and killed. Well, he didn't die immediately, but he died soon after. It's the only casualty I can recollect in relation to the bombing of the hospitals. The most pathetic casualty was this rather nice young Spanish nurse who got typhoid. That was really sad. Such a lot of sad things.
Were most of the nurses trained nurses, or did you have some who sort of volunteered from other occupations?
Well, the British nurses were trained, and the Americans. We had both, British and Americans. They were magnificently well-trained nurses with tremendous sense of devotion and all the rest. They wouldn't have come to Spain otherwise, most of them wouldn't. Only one came for peculiar reasons, you might say. She was an interesting person. But I won't mention her name. She didn't like the conditions under which she worked. She felt she was being exploited and put upon, and she probably was. She worked in a nursing home in London, or near London, and she felt the matron was taking advantage of her and overworking and underpaying her and all this sort of thing, you know. She was disgruntled, perhaps with good reason. And one day she was glancing out of a window in this nursing home where she was working, and she saw some kind of demonstration or march which was in support of the Spanish Republic. And she said to herself, be damned, I'll go to Spain, I'll give up this for a lot. And she went out and joined the march, left her job, and volunteered to go to Spain. Now, she was completely non-political type. She wasn't a person, politics, didn't understand them, didn't think about them, wasn't interested in them, really. She came almost out of pique, you know, whatever it was. She was a quaint person. But she was a good nurse. All the English nurses, all the American nurses were good nurses, and having decided to do this, they gave of their skill to the best of their abilities, and they really had a tough time when things were active. Really bad. Well, you know, a lot of the history of the war is to be found in General Franco's museums. Well, they're not his museums now, but the Historical Museum in Madrid. There they've managed to collect an enormous number of journals of the international brigades that were published during the war. And there, people wrote about things that happened during the war. And a lot of these nurses' names will appear in these, because, nurses make good news matter. And a lot of them got written up by grateful patients and others, you know. So that, anyway, these American British nurses were marvellous. Now, the Spanish nurses were not so well trained. Many of them were not nurses to start with at all. Now, take the case of one who came, what's her name, Aurora, who now lives in Prague. Now, Aurora was just a young Spanish girl, about 17, 18, something like this. And when the war came, people were invited by the Spanish government to train for jobs needed in the war, and amongst other possible jobs they could train for, one was nursing. And so she and another friend of hers, two girls, decided to volunteer to train as nurses. And when they'd had quite a short training, 6 months or something like this, then to the nurses' school came a request: was there anyone who'd like to I think various different units they could join, but at any rate there was a request for nurses to join with the International Brigades. And Aurora came to us. Well, she did a really wonderful job in spite of her very brief training, because the English and American nurses then proceeded to add to her knowledge, you see, and train her further. And she became a really wonderful nurse. I got to this picture of her tending one or two wounded over here. So that was there was in-service training going on all the time, and many Spanish nurses, they were always a little bit, what should I say, subservient, perhaps isn't the right word, but feeling that if it was anything at all difficult, they would refer problems to the British and American nurses, or ask their advice, or learn from them, and there's always just a little bit of feeling that possibly the Anglo-Saxon nurses were a little bit better than the Spanish. But after all, there's so much in nursing that doesn't require enormous surgical skill and knowledge, that is a sort of a human thing, isn't it? I mean, washing and feeding and helping them with various bodily functions which they're not able to help themselves with and so on is a thing that can be learned fairly quickly. And even minor surgical things, bandaging and cleaning wounds and so on, they pick it up. People pick those sort of things up very quickly. When it comes to more complicated surgical instruments and how to help in operations and so on, that is takes a bit more knowledge.
How about the situation regarding the doctors, medical staff? Would you say there was any difference there, or any perceived difference between the different national groups?
No, I think that depended more on their actual skills and knowledge and abilities and experience and so on. I mean, for instance, we had this man who was an oculist. Well, it's no good to some other doctor who knew very little about the anatomy of the eye dealing with injury to the eye if there's an oculist present, even though he's Hungarian and the other one's a Spaniard or an American. It just, the oculist does the job. And when it came to major surgery, I would hate to have had to do major surgery. Of course, I mean, I would feel ill at ease and know very well that I might make serious mistakes. So that I never attempted major surgery. I did minor surgery, yes, but nothing like opening an abdomen or, you know, person with a wound where all sorts of organs might be damaged. I mean, it wouldn't do the patient any good, and it'd do me a lot of harm too.
But it seemed that you were all the time progressing your knowledge of blood transfusion.
Oh, yes.
Would you
yes.
say that? That you were
I think so. Well, skill so as to save time, maybe do more. I remember in one of these hospitals, you know, I mean, well, there's so much demand all at once. As I have said, I did acquire assistance to help me, because at the beginning I gave a transfusion, I had to stay with it and see it through to the end. I couldn't sort of leave the patient and hope it to be all right and then get on with something else. And if the thing stopped running, or the needle came out of the vein, or, well, it wouldn't have come out as a canner, but it still he could thrash about if he got, you know, in some way, what should I say, upset, or perhaps he fainted or something. And so that I had to stay with the patient and see it through to the end. Well, then gradually I trained one or two assistants, or got one or two assistants, so that I could get the thing going, leave the assistant to look after it, and go on and get on with something else. But I can remember occasion a surgeon came herring after me, said, come quickly, we want a transfusion. This was a Spanish surgeon, for this patient. I said, well, I'll come as soon as I can, but I'm giving one right now to this patient here. I can't leave him. I'll come as soon as I've finished. And the poor surgeon, he was this interesting Spanish exclamation, caramba, he said, caramba, which is, it's a lovely word, caramba, I rather like it.
Yes, what does it mean?
Yes, it doesn't really mean anything. It's an explanation of astonishment, I think. I used to think it meant something worse, but no, it's just...
That's quite a useful
Karama.
Yes, bad, I think, yes. Did you have to ever have to examine people, you know, to see whether they were fit for medical duty or
yes,
not?
Yes, I can only once recollect a sort of official examination. Of course, if people have been injured and you want to know if they're recovered or not, that's another thing, just for the individual patient. But on one occasion I went to a recruiting centre. I can't remember where it was or when it was, but I remember going, and we stayed in a little village for a day or so. Day and a night, I think. I remember lodging in this little house in the village. Anyway, then we examined people just to see if they're physically fit to be recruited or whether they're unfit for military service. These were new recruits. And I don't know how many people there were, a vast number, but I think there were a certain number who, I mean, it was doubtful whether they were fit or not. So there was sort of leftovers from the recruiting drive of people who was thought perhaps were not medically fit. And there we just did a simple physical examination. One person I was not sure about. He apparently was deaf and dumb. Apparently. But I don't know. I think he was a shepherd from some distant, who worked in some distant mountainous area. And I suspected he was playing deaf and dumb to avoid military service.
But there had been conscription then, quite a rigid conscription.
Yes, these were conscripts. Mm. And I think he was avoiding military service. I didn't know, and I didn't say what I thought, because there was no way that I could prove it. And he was an insignificant sort of fellow, ugly and and unhappy sort of person. I think he wanted to be back with the sheep on the mountain, really, and left alone to live his little life. So we had to say he was unfit for military service, and off he went. But I never knew.
Were there many deserters? Did you have?
There were deserters. Yes, there were deserters from the international brigades, and from you might say people who went on leave without permission from our lot. A few ambulance drivers, and I think, generally speaking, these were of that minority who came without real political conviction to start with. People who perhaps had an element of adventurism in their reason for coming and weren't prepared to put up with the really harsh conditions which prevailed at times in the way of living conditions, dieting conditions, hygiene conditions, clothing conditions, cold conditions. Everything was very trying. I mean, we set up sometimes a special shower arrangements for people because there was no means of bathing. We had all sorts of complicated things, but I mean, I had lice. Everyone had body lice, you know. And, you got used to them. Anyway.
What would have happened so to the deserters if they were found?
Now, some deserters, well, they were charged. They were before some kind of court, a military court or some kind of court, and their case was considered carefully. In the case of international brigades, very often representatives of the brigades would go and watch over their interests, and if there was something to do with somehow connected, say an ambulance driver or something like that, with the medical aid committee, I can't remember, but I think we would have sent someone to go and see that they had the best chance of getting off reasonably lightly. Now, if they're deserted in a violent sort of way, as one or two did, such as seizing a vehicle, perhaps threatening with a gun, then they were liable to a capital punishment. But if they were just, you know, poor, exhausted, worn out, frightened people, then they'd be treated more leniently, you know. Maybe they get punishment of being imprisoned for a while, or maybe just sent back to the unit.
I wonder how many were actually killed.
Deserters?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know about that. No idea. You see, I don't suppose there are any records from which you could get that information. But certainly there were deserters, and if they had British connections, for instance, they'd go and try and take refuge if they felt this was their objective, was to get away. Whatever happened in the British Embassy or something like that, there were several did go there in Barcelona or Valencia. This was where they'd get to if they could, I think. Then they'd get shipped out in some British vessel or something way. But many were caught, and as I say, some of them. I can recollect one foolish fellow who, in fact, got a vehicle in a military car park and drove it past the sentries, and the sentry told them to halt and were shot. Well, I mean, I think that particular fellow was shot by the sentries before he came to any court or anything at all, as he drove out when told to halt. So that people deserted did suffer that sort of fate in hot blood, you might say, or hot pursuit. But execution afterwards, I don't know so much about that. I do know that many of them didn't get executed.